We're not here to endorse, enforce, change your course. We're not doctors, lawyers, or professional counselors or therapists. Please call those folks directly. This show is meant to get us all comfortable with thinking about our deaths, with thinking about a plan for our loved ones after we've departed, and an idea of what we believe. In doing so, we're forced to look upon our lives. When we do this, we leave with a little more thankfulness, a little more love for ourselves, our lives, our loved ones, and what we've accomplished so far in this short period on Earth. Good morning, everybody. Aloha.
Aloha.
Today, we're delving into the deeply meaningful topic of Hawaiian death rules, Hawaiian death rituals, and beliefs about the life and the afterlife. Thank you so much for joining us, Kumu.
Mahalo for having me.
Would you introduce yourself properly with your full, amazing, beautiful Hawaiian name?
Well, my full name.
Yes, yes.
My legal name. Actually, I have a long name. It's Lavena Melanie Kehaulani Kekua. So my middle name is the name that I was addressed, communicated with my my family. I mean, everybody knew me as Kehau or Kehaulani when I was in trouble. Or when I was really in trouble, then my mother would call me by my full name. But yeah, so Kehaulani is actually my middle name. And so there's a period in time in my life that I know, like if I'm in the store or somewhere and somebody calls out Lavena, I know exactly what part of my life that is. So it was from when I went to preschool, or then we called it nursery school, till the sixth grade.
There we go.
Because, you know, that's what you get registered at, is the teachers call you that. And My good friends always called me Kehau, but in general, I was Lavena to the world here on Kauai during school. And then when I got accepted to the Kamehameha schools on Oahu, I begged my mom to change my paperwork so that I could go by Kehaulani. So yeah, we kept the initial, you know, L. We dropped the M because it was just one too many initials. So just went, all my paperwork was registered as L. Kehaulani Kekua, and I continue to do that today.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the most part, people know me as Kehau or Kehaulani or Kumu Kehau.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Mahalo. I'm quite honored. Been looking forward to this. Thank you.
Well, you came and spoke with my hospice volunteer group one time.
Yes.
And I just remember sitting in front of you, and you weren't talking about anything in specific, but it was very, very moving, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd like to share that with everybody today.
That was one of the most meaningful experiences for me, to have been invited to do that. For a long while, I would get, for several years, actually, I would get these calls, you know, asking if I could come and do the, you know, the training with the hospice volunteers and the staff. And I was always busy, or something always conflicted with my schedule. And so finally, when I was able to do it for the first time, I wanted to do it every time they asked.
Yeah.
So I'm quite honored. Caroline Mira is a really good friend, and she's the one that was persistent, you know, to reach out. And so I've really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed that because the people who gather there are there for that specific purpose.
Yes.
You know, to learn, to embrace, to connect to a better level of understanding as to how to be in that space with with the local Hawaiian ohana when they have a loved one that is, you know, going through their final days of life in this earthly realm. And and then I was also able to listen and hear, you know, other spiritual leaders from the community and different religious beliefs, and learned a lot. So yeah, I've really, really appreciated that.
Well, it was valuable to all of us, because sometimes when we go into these settings, there's not, maybe the people aren't religious.
Yes.
But we all live here on Hawaii.
Yes.
And
these things trickle down to them. And so it's been a big, basket to pull from.
Sure.
Even though sometimes, you know, the person's not Hawaiian.
Right, right. And for families that live here on Kauai, you know, you just establish or you begin to nurture your own environment of being and engaging in, you know, in different beliefs or practices depending on who your extended ohana or family and friends influence and support your life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of it's really important. I think that for me, my experience has been the level of interest, the genuine interest in those who have come, because, you know, to volunteer for the Kauai Hospice or any situation like that, you have to want to do the best that you can to support the individual who is going through this transitional process.
Yes.
And then their family. And yeah, there's all kinds of emotions and mm-hmm. family dynamics. And so it's really a tight rope, you know, sort of, because you want to be respectful.
Absolutely.
But you also want to be supportive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Let's just go ahead and dive in.
Okay.
So how is death traditionally viewed in Hawaiian culture?
Well, I can only speak for me personally. Death is not a scary thing for me. It is something that I was exposed to at a very, very young age. Mm-hmm. My kupuna, my maternal grandparents, spoke openly about it. I was always taught to be very respectful when there were adults in the house, that it wasn't my place to like hang out around the kitchen table where everybody had gathered, and that, but they didn't like lock me away in the room. I could listen from afar or from my room,
they
or
weren't hiding
be in the
it.
Living room. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't stow me away and tell me, cover your ears and don't listen. So I was exposed to a lot of discussions that I was quite fascinated by. And thinking back, some of the stories are really, really heavy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people would say that was really scary.
Yeah.
But my experiences growing up around my elders was very open when it came to spirituality and beliefs,
mm-hmm.
and practices of all kinds of different rituals in whatever we did.
Yeah.
So as a young child, I'm the oldest of four siblings, four offspring, all girls. And my grandmother was a master kumuhula. And so before I was born, there was an agreement between my grandmother and my mother specifically, but, you know, within our family, that this firstborn child that she was going to have would be traditionally hanai, or given to her, mm-hmm. to be raised in hula.
Mm-hmm.
So we always lived in the same hale. We always lived in the same house, but my grandmother was in charge,
mm-hmm.
not my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so between my myself and my second sibling was 3 years younger than me. So that little window, I was the only one.
Yeah.
And even after my sister Kawehilani was born, I was still at the foot of my grandmother, went everywhere with her, did everything with her, because of my upbringing in hula. None of my sisters were required to do it. And I always used to think that was unfair. But here I am, you know, six decades plus later, very humbled and grateful to have had that exposure and that immersion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that being in the lineage of a kumuhula is how it puts you in that in that job.
Yeah. Yeah, so I really didn't fully realize what the height of the expectations were and the depth of responsibilities. I was just told from a very young age, from when I could understand, the communication was that this was my responsibility, and one day I was going to be the kumuhula. And for a good part of my young life, I didn't understand what the heck that meant. I just thought, oh, well, I can teach the dances. But as I grew much older, I realized that it wasn't that.
Right.
It wasn't limited to that. That is a small fraction of the responsibilities that I was raised in, mm-hmm. and then I inherited upon my grandmother's passing.
Mm.
Yeah. Phew. Yeah.
Amazing.
So, fortunate. Yeah. So, being around death and dying and being exposed to different rituals and practices, when I was young, mm-hmm. a lot of the wakes and funerals took place in people's homes.
Is there one that sticks out for you?
Yeah, I mean, my grandparents would take me with them,
yeah.
to people's homes, and I was like, wow, what is a casket doing in the living room? And at first, you know, you're a little startled, and it's weird. I mean, and I was, you know, I was born in 1962. So many of my peers had never been exposed to any of that. But there were still some Hawaiian families that were doing it. And so I had experienced that several times as a child growing up. And then the older I got, the more rare and non-existent it became. And so, you know, the run of the mill was at the mortuary, they would have the wakes and the funerals, and the churches.
Right.
You know, and the churches. And so when, you know, including my grandparents, both of my grandparents, when they passed away, we didn't have any of that. Both of their funerary services were held at the what is now the Borthwick Mortuary in Koloa, and my father, their family on Maui were of the Mormon faith, so it was at the LDS, Latter-day Saints Mormon Church in Kahului, and. But when it came to my mother, she insisted that we talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing that is really, really important, is that whatever is the wish of the individual,
yeah.
it's so important to honor that. Whatever it is they want,
yeah.
you know, they want to be cremated. And so, you know, in the Hawaiian culture, traditionally, cremation was not practiced. We have a long-standing belief that our mana, our spiritual power and energy, lives on in the bones after we die.
In the Ivi,
exactly. And so the practices of our kupuna, of our ancestors, were to ensure that the Ivi, well, the body itself, and then the Ivi was processed in such a way that the bones could be collected, cleaned and collected, and kept safely, whether it was hidden away. But, you know, if you look at many of our mo'olelo, or oral traditions and stories, we see how families in ancient times processed their loved one after they passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept the Ivi, like they kept their main bones, you know, wrapped up in a pu'olo or in a bundle that was kept within the house. Or if it was of an ali'i class or of chiefly class, those bones would be secretly hidden
somewhere.
somewhere.
In a puka somewhere.
Whether it's in a cave or buried at sea or secretly taken care of, because of the understanding that the mana of that individual remained in the bones. So fast forward to my adulthood. One day, by then my mother had already had a series of strokes, and then she had her health was declining, and so after the scare of the strokes, I realized that she needed to have someone just be around her and take care of her. So as the oldest child, I understood that that was my kuleana. I didn't mm-hmm. have children. I didn't have a family. I had a very busy professional and personal life.
Yeah.
But all of that didn't matter, because my makuahine, my mother, was the most important responsibility that I had. So I had to move home. And that was hard. That was really, yeah. really hard. I'd been independent for so long, because I had lived out of her home for most of the time every year as a border student at the Kamehameha schools.
Yeah.
So when I graduated and I came back home, all of those strict rules that was there when I was a kid was still there.
As an adult.
As an adult. And I grappled with it. It was hard. Yeah. So I actually, you know, I couldn't handle it. I moved out when I was 17. I'm a late born baby. My birthday is in November. And
yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
I'm old enough. I'm responsible enough. You know, I'm so foolish. I think I roll my eyes as I say that, because I thought I was. So anyway, I had lived on my own. And then when my mother started to have health issues, I moved back home. And it was tough. And she couldn't drive. She had a massive stroke, which left her paralyzed on her left side of her body from head to toe. So she needed constant care and a lot of assistance. She couldn't drive. She couldn't walk.
Right.
And so
helping her in and out of bed.
Helping her everything.
Eating,
cooking, mm-hmm. showering, cleaning, transporting her to doctor's appointments or whatever it was. And I remember one day I came home from work and she told me, I've two funerals I have to go to this weekend. So can you take me? And I said, sure, you know, just let me know when. And I blocked my calendar. And my sister and I asked my sister if she could come with me, and, you know, for the company or whatever. And so we both, we both went, and we decided to take turns driving. I would drive over and she would drive back. And my mom was, of course, the co-pilot, telling us what to do and where to go. And so the first place that she said that we'd go to Kekaha.
Oh, God.
So I was like, okay, who the heck is in Kekaha? And so she said, oh, turn over here, turn over here. I said, Mom, I don't know. You know, this is not right. I mean, this is like in the middle of nowhere. And she said, no, this is the house. Just go follow my directions. So we pull up to this old plantation home, like old. It's like falling apart. And I felt really uncomfortable. I said, Mom, you know, I don't know. Because she also had early stages of dementia. And so I thought, okay, she's making up all of this stuff.
Oh, no.
And both my sister and I were looking at each other like, you know, I don't know, you know. So she said, pull up the car and go and make sure that this is the house. So I pulled up and I walked out and was a little embarrassed. And so I called out, you know, hi, aloha, you know, is this the such and such ohana hale? And they said, oh, yeah, come inside. I was like, oh, my God, she's right. So I went back to the car. She said, you see, I told you. She said, take me in, just bossing us around to unload her wheelchair. And so we did. And so we went in through the kitchen. It was a little challenging because she was in a wheelchair and going up wooden steps and a narrow doorway, but we managed to get her in. And then so we went in through the kitchen, and whoever it was, that knew my mother, you know, obviously knew my mother, said, oh, go in the living room, go in the parlor. Does it call it, go in the parlor. So we go through the kitchen and we enter into the parlor, because we called it the parlor when we were growing up. And there was a casket in it. This was in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't that long ago. Mm-mm. And my younger sister Noi, had heard our kupuna talk about it, but she had never experienced it. So it was strange for her. It was heavy for her.
Was it open?
It was an open casket. Yeah. It was an open casket. And so we stayed there for a while, and they offered us to eat something, and my mom visited, and she was so grateful and happy that we were able to take her. And then we had a second stop, which is very brief, and then all the way home she couldn't stop talking about it. And she said, okay, you know, when I die, that's what I want for me. Mm. And my sister and I just looked at each other and we said, oh, Mom, don't talk about that. And that was a bad habit that I had. Oh. She would bring it up because our time together was at the kitchen table in the morning while she was having breakfast. And every now and then she'd bring it up. This is what I want when I die. I want you to, you remember like when we went to Kekaha, and I want to come home, and I would always tell her, oh, Mom, don't talk about that. Don't talk about that. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. So, I was in my own self-denial.
Right.
Not wanting to talk about it, but she insisted. And I'm so grateful for her that she insisted, and she made sure to tell me every detail of what she wanted. Mm. So when it became her time, leading up to it, even long before she had, you know, passed away in 2006. Mm. Over the years, she kept reminding me, and I kept assuring her that I would hold onto that promise.
Yeah.
So that's what we did, you know, and it made a lot of people uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's a big promise to commit to.
It's a big promise. But it's her decision, and my responsibility was to honor that.
Yeah.
And so within the family, it was strange. There was, you know,
what are you doing?
Other family members did not agree. There was a lot of
scratching heads,
uncomfortable anger, bitterness even. But I was like, you know, you can be mad at me all you want. That's what our mother wanted.
And it's such tradition. I mean, it's what the world always did. We talked about, you know, everybody got buried even on their land, let alone.
Yeah.
And that's, it's gotten so far from that closeness.
Yeah, totally.
It's a beautiful story.
Yeah, and you know, I can't even remember the year, but you know, in not the too far away distance, we didn't even have burial laws in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Until there was a huge development on Maui, which is where the Ritz-Carlton at Kapalua is, where they were excavating the land and they were literally unearthing hundreds of iwi kupuna, from babies to all ages to elders. And so the people from the community and people from across the Paiaina, across the island chain, traveled to Maui to put themselves before the bulldozers and insist that things stop. And it was a lot of work. Yeah. So one of my master kumu was part of that. In fact, two of them were part of that. And that's Hokulani Holt from Maui and Pualani Kanakaole Kanahele from Hawaii Island. And the Kanakaole family, Pualani Kanakaole Kanahele and her husband, Uncle Edward Kanahele, were the pioneers of of, I wouldn't say reviving these practices, because in our ancestors' time, we didn't have to worry about digging up burials.
Right.
Because there was an understanding that the Iwi-Kupuna were sacred. But as time marched on, and with no laws protecting our ancestral remains, there was a big struggle. So there were vigils that were held at the state capitol. There were protests that were done, and this took several years.
Yeah, because it was happening all over the place.
It was happening all over. It's still happening today, and even with burial councils being put together on each of the islands, you know, people who are entitled or because they can afford it, they have a lot of money, they can go up against the politics of things and pay the fines or whatever it is, and don't respect the way and the traditions of the Hawaiian people and the Hawaiian lands, make it a gigantic struggle. So, you know, our ohana in the communities across of the island chain are still, you know, it's still a challenge.
Yeah.
And they're having a very difficult time. However, with that said, there are more of us today that are very comfortable with standing up. And we know the prayers, and we know the ceremonies, we know the rituals. And a lot of that came out of the nonprofit organization Huimalama Ina Kupuna Hawaii, which was founded by Polani and Edward Kanahele, and also a very dear friend who continues the work, Hale Aloha Ayao, have literally trained hundreds of people in the communities across the islands. Mm-hmm. And so we've learned how to revive the practices of making kapa again, which is fiber cloth, because that is what we wrap the Iwi-Kupuna in when they are, quote unquote, air quotes, inadvertently disturbed.
Unearthed, yeah.
And have to be removed and relocated, but there are laws now that there needs to be a burial treatment plan. Whether or not people honor it is a whole different ball game. But we weave lauhala again to make hina'i, to put the wrapped iwi, wrapped in kapa, into the lauhala baskets. There are rituals and prayers and ceremonies that have been learned by families and members in the community. So when that does happen, we know how to step up. We know what to do. So those responsibilities not only lie within families, to me, that is the biggest, most important, and the best way to maintain the kuleana, or the responsibilities, is to ensure that members of your family are trained and learned in these practices. And that's hard.
Yeah.
That is hard. Unless the younger generations, unless the members of the family from a very young age is exposed to it, mm-hmm. or are learning these things, it's weird. It's scary. Yeah. It's, you know, people can't relate to it.
Well, you have to step in front of that power, and it's intimidating.
Yeah. And like for me, I will always be grateful for my mother, Lady Ka'ipuai Ululani Kikua, and my grandmother, Helen Ka'ipuai Kikua Waiau, and then also my grandfather and my father as well. But because of these two matriarchs in my family who insisted, you know, that I be exposed to these things, the learning for me came very easily. I had that interest that I had from when I was a keiki, long into my adulthood, and even now, more so. And so it's my practices in hula, not only from my grandmother, but from my other master kumuhula that I've learned and trained from, that I've learned many of these things.
Well, you were so steeped in it. You know, it was very normal.
It was very normal.
Very normal.
And the older I got, I was exposed to elevated opportunities
yeah.
that I may not have had when I was young from my own grandmother. But what I learned from her is the importance of ritual. Mm-hmm. When we, like, she would take me up into the forest as a young kid. I was barely walking. But I witnessed her doing things that I learned from. I learned how to behave. I learned how to stand quietly. I learned how to observe. I learned how to see things that were not so obvious. And a lot of that was not only learned experiences, but I really do believe that they were also inherent in my DNA.
Right.
That, you know, for generations of hula masters and kahuna in my family, that I had that. I didn't understand that until I was much older.
It sounds like when you went back to home to take care of your mother.
Exactly.
All of those things were highlighted again, and you had to stand there in that agency.
I had to stand there. And it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But one day I realized from struggling, you know, and a lot of it was me. The error was on me for being impatient, you know, not wanting to give up my own independency. But I put myself, one day the light bulb went off and I put myself in my mother's shoes. Like, you know, understanding that she no longer has her independency. She's frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
She would rather not be in the situation that she's in. And so my kuleana is to go with the flow, to make her comfortable and happy, and to just be more kind and aware and flexible. And as soon as I realized that light bulb went on, I was like, oh my gosh, I've been missing the boat for so long. But I get it now. And so oftentimes I had to recheck myself, like, yeah, I heard that story a million times, but I'm going to be happy about it.
Yeah.
I'm going to show my mom that I'm happy that she's sharing this with me, even if it is for the millionth time, but I'm going to be dedicated and engaged, and I'm going to be interested so that she feels her worth.
Yeah.
And as soon as I made that shift, it was smooth sailing after that.
Yeah.
And then it became a joy all the time to be her caregiver. And so I always tell people, you know, especially my peers and my friends and even people that don't know me, if somehow we get on the subject and they're in that situation that I was in, I always share my experiences. And I always say, it's the biggest, most profound gift that my mother gave me. And if I could do it all over again, I totally would. And I would be better at it. 500%, I would be better at it. But I would do it again.
We just watched a documentary about caregivers, and it was tragic beyond belief. And your story just now has just, like, opened up that side that hasn't been said. It's like there's so much unsaid, and it goes back to tradition.
Totally.
Back to how we knew we were supposed to be.
Exactly.
All your training. So, God, led
it's
up like,
to that it's
moment.
Profound to me that because I'm watching this horrible thing about caregivers.
Oh my gosh.
And there was no answer. And then.
It's such an important role.
With the vision that you have of it, it's totally different than what America and the world has adapted for what we call caregiving. It's
totally.
Suffering and hardship and horrible.
Yeah.
And you just lighten.
Well, and people don't want to do it.
Yeah,
because it is heavy. It does take away from their own personal journeys to success or whatever. But I have to credit my hula training. My traditional training in hula, and I'm not talking about going to halau and learning dances and chants, but learning the kuleana or the responsibilities.
Because that's like kumuhula and a kahuna. Is this the same?
Well, it depends. So traditionally, it is the same.
Yeah.
Traditionally, it is the same. However, the title of kumuhula for a lot of people is hula teacher. They teach, they're a dance teacher. In my experience, that is not what a kumuhula is.
Yeah, it encompasses so much more.
It is all encompassing. Yeah. And so, you know, when I moved back to Kauai, and my grandmother was still alive, and I'll share this story, you know, and it's, every time I share this story, it's a reminder to myself of a missed opportunity. Mm-hmm. But I was young. I was young. I had great ambitions. And I had, with her permission, had been exposed. I was given the experience, the permission to learn from another kumuhula, from another tradition outside of my family. It was important to my grandmother that I gained this experience. So from this other school of knowledge, I was taught this is the only way you can become a kumuhula, and this is our way. And so when my grandmother, she was still alive when I graduated and I came back home, and she told me, okay, I want you to start teaching. And I looked at her like a spoiled little arrogant young adult, and I said, I can't teach. And she looked at me kind of perplexed, and she said, oh, no, I'm going to teach you how to teach. And I said, oh, no, I have to wait until I'm ready, until my kumuhula that I was learning from at that time says that she will uniki me. And my grandmother was disappointed, but she didn't get angry. And she said, you know, I'm still alive, and I'm here to teach you how to teach and teach you how to be a kumuhula in accordance with our family traditions. And I shook my head and I said, no, you know, I'm going to do it this way. So I know she was really disappointed, and I learned things from her, but I was just really focused on this other path. So in hindsight, I know I screwed up. She continued to inspire, guide, influence me, but I did not have the opportunity because I had been, you know, I had been kind of influenced. I was influenced that it was this way or the highway. But as time went on, I realized that even if people dance with the same kumuhula for 5 years or 20 years, that is all great. But what I had for my grandmother, and so I'm very, very grateful that even during her last years, she continued to support me, learning from this other source, but she would drop gems. Mm-hmm. And every now and then, I would have time with her, and she would share, and she would teach, and she would guide, but not in a very formal way. But there were lessons, and she was training me,
yeah,
without me knowing it. Mm-hmm. I totally realized, especially after being given the genealogy of that matrilineal line from which my grandmother is descended from all these master kumuhula, as well as kahuna, mm-hmm, that what I was born into, what I inherited, was all of the many generations of knowledge, of wisdom, of expertise, of experience. And it was in my genealogy. It was in my DNA. It's in my blood. And so what I have is actual information and documentation that I can trace back the names and the direct lineage from myself to through my mother, but mainly my grandmother, because she was the master Kumuhula. And you know, later on I realized that my grandmother was raised the same way. On the day that she was born, she was Lawe Hanai. She was given to her not her biological mother, but her aunt, actually. So a sister of her grandmother, of her biological mother, was the Kumuhula of that generation. And so the day she was born, she's given to that aunt who became her mama and raised her from when she was a child, you know, all the way through her own passing. And then when I learned of other stories, which I was very fortunate to get from my grandmother, which later on, in hindsight, I was like, oh my God, that was a lesson. She's teaching me all of these things. Mm-hmm. So the genealogies I got from her, the names I got from her, and then there becomes, you go back far enough and then you're stuck, because the information wasn't documented, or it is somewhere but we just don't have it.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people will claim, oh yeah, you know, all of my family, you know, I'm descended from, you know, a long line of Kumuhula, and I will never say prove it to me, because that is, if you make that claim, you have to carry that.
Yeah.
So I do know, because I do have the Mele Mo'okuʻauhau, or the genealogy chant of all of the Kumuhula over the generations by name. You know, and who they're born of, and from which makua or parent did they inherit thinking about is different things, the responsibilities or the kulana, the station, and the responsibilities kulana of Kumuhula.
Mm-hmm.
So I am an eighth generation Kumuhula. I have all of those ancestral names, very humbled to be a part of it. But along with it comes the responsibilities. So I, you know, definitely hope to pass. I mean, I don't have any children. So, and I do have, you know, next generation grandnieces and nephews. Whether or not they will step up to receive it is, I'm hopeful.
So I was reading a book recently written by a doctor who is of Indian descent from India. And she was classically, you know, went to college here in the United States for regular medicine, and then wanted to expand her knowledge to the Ayurvedic way.
Yes.
Right? So she moves to India. She starts going to college, and she realizes that everything that they're teaching in the Ayurveda, they've been doing in their home all along.
Right.
You know? And so that she went to go get this great education, and she already knew everything.
Yeah.
So for your nieces and nephews,
right,
anytime you're around them, you're teaching them the way.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, we, in Hawaii even, you know, we were brought up in a Western system,
yeah,
that says that you are not qualified unless you go to the college, right, or the university. You get the palapala or the diploma, the degree. And I support that higher education. I definitely do. But in no way, shape, or form does that erase what I consider to be even a higher elevated form of formal training,
learning by
and
doing,
knowledge and, mm-hmm, and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
So up until me, our family traditions, practices, and beliefs through hula and ha'a has always been passed on it within the family. But I'm at the crossroads in my life, because I don't have any children, that I have for many years now have accepted the possibility and the idea that I may have to, or I may choose. I might not have. I don't have to do anything, but perhaps, perhaps this opportunity is passed on to someone else or other people who I'm not biologically related to, and I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't okay with that for many, many years. But I'm okay with that. But it's through the formalities of my hula training that I understand the kuleana of taking care of my things and taking care of the people and, you know, primarily my family. So when my mother passed away in 2006, as the eldest child, which then puts me in charge, of course, and I was also a main caregiver, I shared with my sisters that it was important to me that we take care of our mother. And so they're like, okay, well, what do you mean? And they said, well, that means that I've made arrangements with the mortuary and the director at the mortuary to be able to go in and dress her and prepare her for her ho'olewa, for her, you know, her for her the rituals and the funerary ceremony that we had already arranged to bring her home. So, you know, when I sat down with the funeral director, mm-hmm. he wasn't shocked at the things that I was asking. And he was more than happy and flexible and supportive to do whatever he could on his side to enable her to come home.
Yes.
So the only thing that, you know, that I was kanalua or caught between a rock and a hard place about was, and I understand it, that it is a Department of Health requirement that if that is to happen, then she had to be embalmed.
Embalmed, yeah. After the 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's because she's going to be in, handled, you know, in the presence of people. And so that was a decision that I had to make. And I was okay with that because that was the only way we could uphold her wishes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to do that. Yeah. And so being in close proximity and having that time with the loved one after they have passed away, and even in the hospital. So my mom passed away in the hospital, and we were given all the time that we needed to just be with her. They were supportive. They were totally supportive of things that I felt that I needed to do ritual-wise whenever something came up. So one example is, and my mother's health was declining very quickly after she had been transferred by ambulance to the hospital. And she was unconscious for a good amount of the time. Like she was heavily induced and, with medication and stuff like that. But I knew, because I knew how I could communicate with her spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew how to read and look for the ho'ailona or the signs that I was connecting with her. And so one good example is, you know, the one day the doctor came in and he said, you know, your mother's condition is declining, and so she's going to need a blood transfusion. So I said, yeah, no problem. You know, I'll sign the paper, let me know what I got to do and stuff. They said, oh, okay. You know, the nurse is going to come in, or somebody's going to come in, and they're going to make those arrangements. So I said, okay. And then, you know, after they came in and I signed the paper and they said, okay, we'll be back in about 40 minutes, you know, to do that. So I said, okay. And then right when he walked out, it's like something hit me all of a sudden. Like I understood clearly, oh my God, I didn't even think about this. I don't even know who or what the condition of the person or the source that this coco or this blood is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how, you know, what kind of condition was this person in? Or, you know, did they have kaumaha? Did they have problems? You know, because that itself is going to be transferred with the transfusion to my mom. And so at that time, I understood that, okay, now I got certain things I got to do to kick in to cleanse and purify that space for her.
Kumu mode.
Right. And just prepare her so that she can receive this. And even when they came with all the gadgets and the, you know, the bag of the, you know,
the bag of blood.
Mm-hmm. I was like, there's got to be another term
for it.
The
unit.
And so I said, you know, I said, very gently and respectfully, I said, you know, are you okay if I do a pule and a ritual to bless this gift that is being presented to my mother? And they were totally fine with it. They were totally fine with it. So, you know, people have to understand there are times that you're going to be in a situation that you never thought of, or you will not have been prepared. And then you need to adjust in whatever way that you have to accommodate the moment or whatever the need is. And so for that, I'm very grateful to my formal upbringing and training in hula. That's what prepared me.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these things that I learned were not like in the regular training classes that everyone was exposed to. So there are many things that I had received over the years separately, whether through my grandmother or through my other kumu, my other master sources of knowledge and training. And so I'm a product of all of their kindness and their willingness to give, you know, and to share of the sacred and the profound. And so to me, that's what it is. Like your first question is, what is death to me? Death is sacred and it is profound. And there's a responsibility. There's like a big kuleana to help that individual, that loved one, to cross over, to guide them through that next journey. So, you know, this included not only, you know, bringing her home, but also my mother, but also me leading and guiding our family and preparing the crematorium before she's cremated. And, you know, all we have to do is ask, and, you know, whoever it is on the receiving end of it, who is the director of the funeral home or the mortuary, we just have to discuss and express why this is important. And for the most part, they will always want they will always want to do what is not only appropriate, but what is best for respecting that loved one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And providing some closure and some ritual.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, when we were little, when I was little and I used to go to funerals at my grandparents, the one thing that they always did, and at first it was weird to me, but I trusted my grandparents. And, you know, you're so little that you can't even see above of the casket. So they lift you up as a keiki. And it's, oh, this is so-and-so. This is your tutu. You know, kiss tutu goodbye. And so you kiss your loved one. People freak out about stuff like that. But you go to a Hawaiian funeral. Yeah, we have no problem kissing the, you know, that loved one that's in the casket.
Yeah.
But there are things that we know we have to do after participating in things like that. We need to purify and cleanse ourselves because, you know, we've just merged our living self with someone who has passed on. And so there's a purification and cleansing ritual to be released from that kaumaha, we call it that kaumaha, that heaviness of being in that headspace of sadness, of heartache, of pain, of death. But we engage in that and we're present in that space until we are pow with honoring that person. And then when we put that person to rest, then we need to go back and take care of ourselves. And so there are different rituals that we do, whether it's pikai, which is a cleansing by the sprinkling of consecrated water. There's certain prayers. And always what is really good is going to the ocean.
Mm.
For the ritual of kapukai, which is total immersion in the ocean to release whatever it is, you know, the burdens, the pain, the heaviness, the unseen. And so we always have to remember that there's an unseen presence or presences. And, you know, we have to let them know, let our loved ones know that, you know, when we're pow, you're going to continue your journey. So you cannot come home with me.
Yeah.
I know you're going to want to. And you can come and check in, but your job is to take the next step on your journey to the next life cycle. You know, because it doesn't end here. It continues at a whole different place. So in the Hawaiian culture, we have, in our practices and beliefs, we have what we call aumakua, or the aumakua worship, right?